Church, open your Bibles. We are going to be in the Gospel of Matthew this morning. We'll read that in just a moment. I'm beginning a brand new Christmas series today, and it is called The Villains of Christmas. I'll explain that in a moment. This is the time of the year when we start to watch Christmas movies. I am wondering if anybody has a Christmas movie under the belt yet. Raise your hand if you have done that. Oh, we have a... Oh, good. About maybe 20 of you or so. I like that. I have not done that yet, but I still, you know, have that's a plan as the Christmas season unfolds. For me, you know, it's hard to beat Elf. I've got here Elf and the Will Ferrell, who plays the figure, and here he is with the other elves at the North Pole. And, you know, I love some of the expressions on his face, and just, you know, the whole thing is filled with a lot of fun and joy. Well, one of the things that you will notice if you watch Christmas movies is that a good Christmas movie nearly always has a villain. So let me show you some of the villains from famous Christmas songs. We've got Home Alone, and we've got the robbers, and they obviously get foiled. We've got the Grinch, who despises Whoville. We've got our next slide. We've got Mr. Potter in It's a Wonderful Life, and remember, he's the land baron. And then we've got Hans Gruber from, Die Hard. And some of you are saying it doesn't even qualify as a Christmas movie. It does in my book. Here's what I'm going to say. Well, guess what? Christmas stories oftentimes also have a villain. And the villain is the person who wants to thwart the story of Christmas. They want to thwart or stop the trajectory of God as if they could. But they're the ones that are stepping into the story, and they are the antagonists, as it were. And in this Christmas series, I'm going to bring to you, over the course of the next number of weeks, four of the villains. And you're going to say to a couple of the villains, yes, oh boy, I see that very crystal clear. There'll be a couple of other villains that you'll say, whoa, I'm on the edge of my seat. I've got to have you tell me, Pastor, how this person or this thing is a villain, but we'll find that out together. Today, we're going to cover our first villain. He's a slam dunk. If there ever was a villain of Christmas, this is the one that's obvious. We are going to be covering Herod, the ruler of Judea, during the birth time of Jesus. Now, I want to show you a couple of pictures regarding Herod because again, from the Bible's story, he's a smaller figure, but in antiquity, this is a huge figure. I've got a bust of Herod the Great right here, and this is in the Israeli Museum. I've seen that personally while I've been to Israel. And you need to know something about this guy, Herod. He was a Jew himself, and he, because of his family ties, was in good with Caesar in Rome. And so he was given the charge to be the governor over all of Judea. He collected taxes on behalf of Rome. He tried to keep peace as best he could. And one of the things that you'll notice about Herod, if you've read much of the Bible, is there is a Herod and a couple of Herods that keep popping up again and again. And you're like, I'm confused of which Herod there is. And that's because Herod had sons who also became rulers. Now, I do not expect you to memorize this in the least, but here is a little chart that deals with Herod and his sons, as at least the ones that are listed in the Bible. He has more sons, by the way, that are not listed in the Bible, but these are just the ones that are in the Bible story. And so again, you'll see that there's a lot of Herods. They would be known as Herod Antipas or Herod Philip, Herod Archelaus. And so these are individuals who we find in the biblical story, but Herod the Great is the guy that is in charge at the point at which Jesus is being born. Now, you need to know this is a rather treacherous figure. He kills three of his own sons, and one of the writers from antiquity said this. He said, it's better to be Herod's pig than Herod's son. And the reason he said that is because it's dangerous to be a son. Three of them were killed. And so, regardless of what you know about Herod, he's a treacherous figure, but he's a figure that's very large because of one thing, his building prowess. He is a guy that is in charge of all kinds of massive building projects during his lifetime, And they're ones that still exist to this day. Humongous structures that still have the remnants 2,000 years later of being colossally that large in the day. And so again, let me just, only because I want you to get who Herod is and how big he is, I want you to get a couple of the things that he built during his time. And if you ever go to Israel, you'll see these. Here is the first one. It's Masada. And this was his winter palace. So he has his normal palace that is in Jerusalem, but he goes here during the winter because it's cooler and it's pleasant. And he builds his little palace on top of that outcrop of land. And, you know, it's impenetrable because it's got these sides that go up on it. And if you ever go to Israel, I'm anticipating that you will see that. Next in line is one of my favorites, and it is Caesarea. It's on the Mediterranean, and it doesn't look like that today. It's in ruins today, but I'm showing you what it looked like at the time. And Herod builds this because he says, Caesar, I'm building a Roman city for you right here in Judea, and when you sail in with your boat, I want you to be in a Roman city and to prove to you that I'm a good Roman myself. And so this is the architecture of a Roman city. And if you go today, you'll walk through that and you'll see the ruins of all of that. Denise and I have sat right in that Roman amphitheater, which, by the way, still has concerts today in it right there on the Mediterranean. It's massive and very beautiful. There's one more, and it is the top. It's the cherry on top, the peak of all of his building prowess. And Herod has the designation of being the guy that builds the second temple of the Jews, and the one where all the sacrifices are going on and everything else. And he builds that, or I really would say he, you know, completes that. The project has been underway all the way since the exiles came back, but he pours a lot of money, a lot of resources, and it's grander than it has ever been under Herod. And that's the temple in which Jesus will walk into and teach, and he'll actually return to that spot on the eve of his death. That's the location. Now again, that spot is going to be destroyed 70 AD when the Romans come in because of a Jewish revolt, and they basically destroy the entire temple, and they even push all of the remnants of on Temple Mount down into the little valley below. And so again, this is all the stuff that Herod is the guy who has built this. So now that you have a little inkling of who Herod is, he's no wallflower. He's no obscure figure. He's a guy with immense power, and in times of antiquity would have been on the who's who list. And so let's enter into the story of Jesus arriving and what happens with Herod and the individuals that are coming to visit him. In my story today, or the story today from Matthew chapter 2, we're going to notice that there are some individuals who arrive. They're sign watchers. They're people who are looking at the stars, astrologers, as it were, and they have figured out something big is about to happen. And so they arrive to Herod to ask some questions. I'm in Matthew chapter 2, starting in verse 1, and this is the way that the gospel writer Matthew records it. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him, and assembled all the chief priests and scribes of the people. He inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for it is written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared, and he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child, and when you found him, bring the word that I too may come and worship him. After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. I'm convinced that Matthew is doing something with us that's important at Christmas. What he's doing is he's contrasting for us the two kinds of hearts that come towards Christmas. Two groups of people that have hearts at opposite ends of the spectrum. In short, the heart of Herod is dark and all of his followers. And in short, the hearts of the Magi or the wise men are bright or they're light. You have Herod who's filled with fear and concern. You have the Magi who are just like pure as the driven snow with their hearts. Here they are just looking and looking at the stars and trying to find this one that they anticipate so much from. We discover those two kinds of hearts, a heart that's against Christ, a heart that's for Christ, a heart that's hard and is dark, a heart that's bright and is soft and pliable, a heart that's ready, a heart that's balking. Today, I want to follow along on this contrast of hearts and look at the story and find out more about this light heart and this dark heart, and we'll find out more about the story about how those are depicted to us. Okay, so we're going to look at two kinds of hearts that are found in the story today. The first condition of the heart is described as either disturbed or peaceful. So the disturbed heart is on the hard side. Obviously, the peaceful heart is on the bright or the light side. And you'll notice that the story opens up with the Magi who are coming. And we don't know much about the Magi. We know that they're from the east, far away. We don't know what's really been motivating them, but we do know this. They are arriving, and they are anticipating something big. And they said, we've been looking at the stars, and this has shown us that there is one who's being born, and we've got to find him. Their hearts are filled with peace. Their hearts are, you know, painfully naive because they have no idea that what they're going to say to Herod is going to cause this much problems. And in fact, they're at the right spot. If you were coming to find one who was born a king, wouldn't you go to the governor of the region and say, point us in the right direction? He should know, right? But Herod doesn't know. He hasn't been paying attention in that way. And so he is the one who is at the opposite end of peaceful. The Bible calls him disturbed. Now again, the translators in the scriptures have a little trouble with that word because it could either be defined as disturbed or troubled or even alarmed. The word as it's used in the ancient Greek is one that is used around unexpected events. So if you found out, for instance, there had just been a natural disaster or a war that broke out or an insurrection somewhere and you were in power and you discovered that, and then that's kind of the alarm that would be filling your heart at that moment. And so the concept of being troubled is one that is a cataclysmic thing. And Herod hears this news, and it's as if he's just heard there's been an earthquake. I mean, it just shakes him to the very foundations. Why would this make him so disturbed? Well, because he was the one who wanted the title, the King of the Jews. I mean, he was the leader over this whole Judean region, and he wanted the people to recognize he's the king of the Jews. And to find out there's another one that's going to be arriving on the horizon that some are going to call the king of the Jews, well, that was too much. And he was going to be a person that was going to have to work in concert with Rome to find out this enemy and eliminate him. So Jesus, again, has this reaction in people, even today, and a reaction in your heart and a reaction in the world around, you're going to find Jesus to be one who's even agitating to you, disturbing to you, or you're going to find out Jesus is one who's bringing peace to you. And there's kind of no middle ground. That's where it is. Jesus tells us very clearly that we will be treated the same way that he was treated. And so Jesus says, Luke chapter 6, verse 22, if you'll give me that one, it's the next one. Blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you and revile you and spurn your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Jesus says, it's blessed when people are going to treat you in that way because basically they're just reacting to me. I don't know if you knew this or not, but today in this age, is one of the most violent times in all of human history for those who are Christ followers. In fact, Open Doors does a study every year, and they disclose the places around the world where it's most difficult to be Christians. And here's the next slide. More than 365 million Christians suffer high levels of persecution and discrimination for their faith around the world. One in seven Christians are persecuted worldwide. One in five Christians in Africa are highly persecuted. Two in five Christians in Asia are highly persecuted. And Open Doors has a way to kind of explain that. And one of the ways that they explain that is that they say there's some things that are done to pressure or squeeze Christians, and then there's other things that are done that's meant to be the smash of the ultimate sense of violence. So what they mean is there's a lot of precursors that work their way up to those actual acts of violence that ultimately occur. Here's the squeeze techniques. First of all, it happens in your private life. What freedom does a Christian have to worship and own religious materials? Is conversion to Christianity allowed? Is freedom of thought permitted? In your family life, how free are Christians to express their faith within their family? Is it possible to hold Christian family milestones, such as Christian marriages or funerals? In your community life, can Christians live without harassment and discrimination in their local communities? How does their faith affect their education and employment? In your national life, does the government allow Christians to express their faith? Can converts call themselves Christians on official documents, and do the police target Christians? And then finally, as those are the squeeze, the violence may happen, and are Christians attacked mentally or physically? Do they face sexual harassment? Are they arrested, abducted, tortured, imprisoned, or even killed? And so Open Doors is telling us there's a lot of individuals around the world who are not safe, and they are persecuted because Jesus is this figure that is so agitating. I love my friends from Pakistan here, and I've talked to them a few times, and Shaw has reminded me that one of the great things he feels in America right now is freedom to worship, is freedom to be here right now, is freedom to be able to say, I'm a Christian, and I'm going to worship Christ, and very little, obviously, things that might happen as a result of that. That's not true in Pakistan right now, and it's not true around the world. And so there is this reaction around the world, two kinds of hearts, dark heart, light heart, or bright heart. And the dark heart, first of all, is agitated, and the light heart is peaceful. Let's go on in our story and discover what's next. The second way that we might describe two kinds of hearts is either deceitful or worshipful. On the light side, the Magi are pure. They simply want to find the baby and worship him, and they believe that he is the true and upcoming leader. Herod, on the other hand, has the darkened heart, and he is showing a level of deceit. The dictionary calls deception or deceit, it's the act of misleading or deceiving somebody by presenting false information or concealing the truth to manipulate beliefs, decisions, or actions. So Herod starts off okay because he says, you know what, let's find out where this Messiah is supposed to be born. So he asks his leaders around him, tell me, you know, you guys are in the scriptures. Where's the one supposed to be born? That's the Messiah. And they come back with the right answer. They say it's in Bethlehem. And so he gives the right answer to the Magi and says, you're going to find him in Bethlehem. But then he says this, why don't you find him and then return to me, because I want to worship him too, which is a bold-faced lie. He only wants them to act as spies. And that's what he's trying to do, is deceive them to bring information back to him so that he can act. Why do we know that's what he wants to do? Because later in the story of Matthew, we are told that he is so desperate to stop Jesus that he is willing to go and send Roman soldiers to Bethlehem and kill all the baby boys under 2 years of age. And that happens. It's called the killing of the innocents, and that is at Herod's hand. So you either have a heart that is, you know, ready and willing, and you're going to say, hey, I really want to worship, which is what those Magi were ready to do, and we find out in this story that's what they do, completely. And then you have the other one that's wanting to stop Christ, that's wanting to be against him, and that is the heart that is deceitful. I have an interesting story that happened just very recently about deceit, and some of you know this. I am a person that individuals like to pretend to be. And if you're a Facebook friend with me, you know that happened this week. I had somebody pretending to be me and created a brand new account, and we're inviting some of the people that I know to befriend the fake Brian. I also have individuals that are constantly sending out emails pretending to be me. It's not my email address. It's somebody else's email address. But they're sending it out wanting you to believe it's Brian. Well, that happened 2 weeks ago. And the staff received an email from Brian, Pastor Brian, and it was asking them to call immediately. I have something that I want you to do. And most of the staff, I mean, they're not their first rodeo, all right? So they figured that out. But Eric glanced at it, and then Eric popped in my office. He said, hey, you needed to see me? I said, it's a fake. It's a spam. And he said, what? And I said, yeah, all the staff got it, and I have no idea what the guy wants. But he goes, well, I'm going to have some fun with that. So Eric sends back, Pastor, so good to hear from you. What can I do for you? Please go and buy 8 Apple gift cards and send me the photograph of the cards. And Eric thinks quickly and says, but Pastor, you know, we are an Amish congregation. That might not be a good idea. We're not technology people. You know, and he goes on, and well, you know, what would be a better card for you to get? Oh, I'm sure a gift card to one of the stores might be better. Oh, yes, pursue that and send me the link immediately. Eric said, well, you know, Pastor, I could just bring you the cash. Why don't I do that? Oh, no. I want the gift cards. Please send the gift cards. Eric says back, well, you know, we always meet on Wednesday nights in order to have our Bible study. And we usually talk about that ahead of time. And this week's study is on telling the truth and honesty. Do you have any thoughts on that, Pastor? Just get me the gift cards. Eric strung this guy out and strung this guy out. Eric talked about all of his children and what they would think about. And I mean, it was awesome. I think the guy finally sniffed out. This guy is taking me for a ride. At Christmas time, if your heart is light, if your heart is with the Magi, you just want to worship. That's what's driving you. If you have a heart that's against Christ, the dark heart, you're filled with deceit, and you're willing to go and do a lot of things to others to fulfill your own agenda, and that's where Herod was. The third way that we might describe the two kinds of hearts at Christmas is either a heart that is thwarted or a heart that is guided. The story continues. The Magi make their way. And it's as if they're guided by, again, this star in the sky. And they're guided by God himself to say, this is where the baby is, in order to go and worship. And the scriptures are really clear that, I mean, they don't just worship a little bit. But, you know, they are worshiping with no abandon at all. And they are just all in. We're going to find out next week a little bit more about the Magi, because we are going to be talking about some of the villain story of the Christmas around their whole time at the manger. I'll let just plant that seed. But they're also guided in this way because they have a dream. And God comes in and intervenes and says, I'm going to guide you now, not back to Herod, because he has nefarious purposes, and I'm going to make you go the other way so you do not see him. And so the Magi, these wise men, make their way into the Christmas story and make their way out of the Christmas story, never to be seen again, but just brought back into children's plays and manger scenes and all the rest. And so we remember the Magi because of their tremendous visit, but they're in and out of the story. On the other hand, Herod's plans are thwarted. He never does find the baby. And in fact, God is going to move Christ and his family all the way to Egypt, out of the harm of Herod. And so he is thwarted the entire time. He does not get his way. And I want you to hear this. If you are a follower of Jesus, you're being guided. There's an invisible hand that's working always. And sometimes you can see that, sometimes you can't. And the hand of God is massaging situations, it's softening hearts, it's even working amidst major kinds of danger around you or confusion around you. I've got a story that is a favorite story of mine. It's a friend of ours, and I can't tell you her name because of security reasons. But she is from Afghanistan. She is a girl that came to know Jesus and was baptized in a bathtub. She couldn't tell her family that she had followed Christ because she knew that she would be beaten or maybe even killed, and it would be what's called an honor killing because she had shamed the family by coming to know Christ, so she kept that rather secret. She's a powerhouse. She's all of, maybe about 4'10", but she is a giant of the faith. And with women who are Afghani and other groups, she is regularly now mixing and telling the story of Jesus to women who are behind burqas. And the only time they can take those off is when they're with women inside of a home. And so that's where she is. And she has scores of women that are coming to know Jesus in this clandestine way, in this dark country, in these dark places. And scores of them are coming to know Jesus. And here she is, this little diminutive figure that's being guided by the hand of God to hungry hearts all over Afghanistan, Turkey, and the surrounding areas. And it's a marvel to watch. Bright hearts are guided while dark hearts are ultimately thwarted. The Bible deals with the villain Herod, and it talks to us about two kinds of hearts. And so let me ask you this. What is the condition of your heart this Christmas? Is your heart eager and ready to welcome Jesus, or is your heart somehow dark and grudging towards him? I want to give you four tests as we close today to see the condition of your heart. And I know most of us want to be on the side of light and bright, right? But we're all in the process of that. So let me give you four tests, and I'm indebted to Pastor Joe Bernard for these four tests. That's where I first read about them, and I bring those to you today. Here they are. And so this is a way for you to kind of come into the Christmas season and say, how's my heart condition? How am I ready for that? First of all is the test of sacrifice. What am I willing to give up for Christ? And so maybe it's something that you own. Maybe it's something that you value about yourself. But if Christ asks for it, how open are you to give that? What is the condition of my heart as it relates to sacrifice? As it relates to submission, not my will, but yours be done. Am I ultimately okay with that? Am I okay with what God is saying? Or do I have this streak in me that really wants my way? I'm a rather controlling individual, and I don't want to submit control to God. So what's the test of submission as it relates to my heart? The test of sorrow is one, this author says, grief is a measure of love. And so how much does my sin cause me grief? If I've failed to love somebody well, is there grief in my heart over the nature of my sin? Or is really my sin just like, oh yeah, I know I'm forgiven for that, so let me just march on. And so does my heart condition tell me, oh man, I have sorrow over that because I don't want that. And then there's a test of satisfaction. Is my heart captivated and overtaken for one ultimate thing, to know and enjoy God? That's what our ultimate call, our ultimate purpose is. And am I living in that? Is that the greatest thing I want, the greatest thing I could have, better than anything I could own, better than any place I could go in the world? It's what I want, is to have a knowledge of God and to know God and to literally enjoy him. Is that my heart condition? Now, I am smart enough to know, even this test on my own heart, I'm not there yet. And my hunch is neither are you. There's some area of the test where you say, I could go further than where I am right now. I guess the question to ask yourself is, are you on that road? And is it something that you're progressing in? You're not there yet. You're not complete yet. But you're on that path towards that. And is there more ground that could be given over in the real estate of your heart towards Christ? Let me just ask this of you. Do you know Christ? Because those tests of the heart matter little if you don't know him. There's no transformation that can happen unless you know Christ. And so is he one you know? Is it he one you're trusting? Is he one that you've said yes to? I want your life. I want your sacrifice. I want your forgiveness. What could be a better gift to Christ at Christmas than your own heart? And so I call you, if that's not you, to make that true today and say yes to Jesus. Well, friends, that is what I want you to lean into with Christmas with me, is the preparation of your heart. The wise men are an example of coming to Jesus with these light and bright hearts. May we follow the wise men this year. Pray with me. Father, thank you again for this Christmas season. And we ask that our hearts would be prepared for this time. We ask, Lord, that we would have hearts that would match those wise men and would be seeking you out, wanting to find you with all of our hearts, with all of our energy, and that you would be glorified in that. Thank you for these things. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.